dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner, Syracuse. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. The institutions that are driving the worldwide neoliberal economic agenda speak of their activities as development, designed to increase prosperity through economic growth. The well-groomed proponents of these activities speak of their plans and projects in modulated tones of civility, in the conference rooms of elegant hotels, while leaving in their wake a worldwide trail of misery, blood, and pollution. The way for this development is opened by coercion and is meeting increasing and often desperate resistance from millions suffering under these tender ministrations. A growing number of critics, mostly silenced from the mainstream venues of discourse, are articulating an understanding of this development model as global gangsterism. In our first hour of the program, we'll hear from Wolfgang Sachs, who will speak on this in the context of Ecology and Equity from Rio 1992 to Johannesburg 2002. In our second hour, Blake, an anti-capitalist activist with the CLAC in Montreal, will speak on the G8 summit planned for this summer in Canada and the G8's role in this global class war. When the pot-belly beasts chase their
I'd like to just introduce our speaker. I'm going to read from a more official bio first. Wolfgang Sachs studied theology, sociology, and history in Munich, Tübingen, and Berkeley. He has been assistant professor at the Technical University in Berlin. He has been the co-editor of the journal Development, which is comes out of Rome, Italy. He has been a visiting professor at Penn State University. That was from 1990 to 1993. He is currently a senior fellow at the Wuppertal Institute for Climate, Energy, and Environment, which is located outside of Cologne in Germany. He is also a regular guest lecturer at the Schumacher College in England. Since 1993, and just recently having ended a term as the chair of Greenpeace in Germany, he's the editor and author of several books: For Love of the Automobile, Looking Back into the History of Our Desires, The Archaeology of the Development Idea, The Development Dictionary, A Guide to Knowledge as Power, Global Ecology, A New Arena of Political Conflict, Greening the North, A Post-Industrial Blueprint for Ecology and Equity, and finally, Planet Dialectics, Explorations in Environment and Development, which came out in 1999. I met Wolfgang Sachs while he was at Penn State. I was then a graduate student, and I had just come back from 2 years in Jamaica with a volunteer program, and I was sort of a gung-ho graduate student in agricultural economics, thinking that maybe if I learned some economics, I'd better understand the poverty and the desperation that I had seen in Jamaica. I think my first meeting with Wolfgang, he said, "So what are you studying?" And I said, "Well, ag econ, and I'm really interested in development." And he said, "Oh, that's too bad. Maybe we can change that." I don't think he remembers that, but I remember that. And I remember it because even though I sort of was shattered at the moment, I think there was something about it that really resonated with me. I recognized some truth in his disappointment because I myself was becoming disappointed in a field that seemed to be focused more on advanced calculus than understanding poverty and environmental desperation and destruction and political disempowerment. And so I decided to sit in on a couple of his courses. And it's from him that I learned to unpack common words and to reveal through that unpacking the judgments embedded in them. I learned to reconsider and examine more closely concepts, common concepts such as poverty, illiteracy, growth, progress, needs, things that we use very easily without really thinking what is really meant by those or what the history of those words are and what the value judgments are in those words. So I learned to discover their history and the vested interests in their particular articulation, their cultural, political, and economic purpose, the damage done as they justify economic development and its destruction of the environment and community and people's rights. I learned that if we can call the assumptions embedded in these concepts into question, we can begin to reimagine what we really mean by words such as progress. Is economic growth progress? Well, perhaps not. If not, what does progress then look like? What does well-being really look like? What does an economy look like that serves society, all of members of society, humans and non-humans alike? What appeals to me most about Wolfgang's work is that he unveils commonly held truths and turns them inside out. He gives us a whole new framework in which to think practically about how to move from our current resource-destructive economy to one that conserves and preserves resources. While the mission of modern economics has been to defy limits, to overcome them, to override them, Wolfgang argues that we must move to an understanding that limits can be productive. He argues that we can live elegantly within limits through locally intensified economies, regional economies, through production processes that are far less wasteful, producing products that are durable and recyclable. He provides practical ideas through which we can envision, and I quote, a future where a society's competence will be measured in terms of whether it can guarantee well-being without permanent economic growth. This vision is exciting and applicable at all scales, local, national, and international. This evening, his analysis will focus on the global conflict, or at least the global discussions between the northern countries and the southern countries, or the elites in those countries, since the Rio 1992 summit on the environment and development. The discussions and the conflict between the northern and the southern elites focuses on the matters of sustainability and economic justice. Because Wolfgang Sachs recognizes that the South's pursuit for ever greater shares of the global economic pie is bankrupt ecologically, and that the North's demands for environmental parity in terms of regulations disregards the environmental damage it has incurred in the past, Wolfgang Sachs argues that ecology or sustainability can only be achieved if equity is sought within a framework of environmentally unobtrusive development. So I hope we'll learn more about that tonight. The title of his talk is Ecology and Equity from Rio 1992 to Johannesburg 2002.
Good evening or good afternoon. Well, it is a kind of difficult once one is parachuted into a foreign land and somehow then to find your way around, to understand where you have landed and what the people are like. And I don't know you, you don't know me, but nevertheless we are supposed to have a good time for an hour or 1.5 hours. Not so easy. I can only rescue myself out of that slightly embarrassing situation by offering you my perception of, you know, of part of the drama of the world today, hoping that you might pick out the one or the other idea which resonates with you, and also hoping on the other side that you might identify the one or the other idea which does not resonate with you. So the friction of disagreement also is a source of discovery and creation. I would like to organize my little exposition around 6 phrases, if you want. And I give you the phrases beforehand so you can kind of follow what the map is and you can identify when I get lost. So the first little chapter I call, and I dare to do that, I know that is not so easy, dare to do that, to speak about the lesson of September 11th. And the lesson basically is, for me, that's just the sentence, if you want, that now, in a way, justice worldwide has become a condition for national security. Then I go on to the second phrase, which builds on that and says that there won't be transnational justice without ecology. Which then brings me to the third phrase that is called North and South are zombie categories. Then to the fourth sentence, which is, well, it's basically two stories. The one is the salmon story, and the other one is the mosquito story. And if you want, they can be put together under one phrase, which says that in particular the marginalized majority in the world is dependent on resources and living systems. And the fifth chapter, what is more important than poverty alleviation is wealth alleviation. To have the last sentence, you know, creating a resource-light economy is a step towards global justice. Well, I said the first reflection on September 11, although as a non-American, in a certain way, I'm not entitled to do that. However, as a non-American, I'm also obliged to do that, because these events of that magnitude cannot be left to those who have been immediately affected. Also, others have to understand what is happening here. What has been important for me and for others in understanding September 11 was that what jumped on the stage of history was the transnationalization of violence. Let me explain in what sense. Till today, we don't know exactly who it was. So the enemy is faceless, unknown. We know, however, that no traditional enemy is there, no state out there who would be attacking the territory of the United States. No, the attack comes from deep down of the world society, suddenly arriving on the territory of the US. So there is no state, there is no face to an enemy. The attack did not take care of borders like a usual war does. It was, if you want, a borderless attack. In a way, I don't know if you ever noticed that, Al-Qaeda is organized like a transnational corporation, meaning it is organized in a borderless fashion. It is flexible in its locations. It uses places which are most suitable for its own purposes, and it acts as if states didn't exist. In a way, for me, that the attackers, the criminals, if you want, are transnational criminals. For this reason, I think it's totally mistaken to see that attack in any way in traditional categories. Like in traditional categories, like, you know, enemies or foreign states or all of that. I think that's all basically mistaken. You are in front of a situation that violence in future will be non-state violence, partly faceless violence, and it will be transnational violence in the sense states don't matter. In the old days, you call defense system national security. And national security implies there's a territory which got to be defended. And an attacking state, you know, there is a territory I can hit back to. All of that is not the case. All old notions of security have an idea of inside and outside. You think we are here and the enemy is out there. And what we have got to do is defend ourselves against the intruding enemy. Again, this doesn't work in this case. The enemy, where is the enemy? Is the enemy at the outside? It's not true. The enemy was on the inside. But at the same time, it was at the outside. So inside and outside don't work. And then when we come to the anthrax case, the enemy is clearly inside. So again, the inside and outside kind of blurs. This is the deeper reason why today domestic security takes on characteristics of foreign security. And the other way around, foreign security is mixed up with humanitarian interventions and with charitable actions and emergency relief and all of that, because the old inside-outside notion doesn't work. Things are blurring. In the same way, it happens with the victims. Isn't the most mind-boggling experience of September 11 that the American people cannot rely on the protective shield of the American army? So in a sense, even from the victim's point of view, there is this terrible experience that there is no protection. And sure enough, it seems to me from the outside, but confirmed by many people, that enormous shock that even the most powerful nation in the world can be hit, is vulnerable, can be hit right into the underbelly. Now, what does that mean? It seems to me, generalizing, that now, if you want, globalization has reached violence. We have globalized goods, we have globalized information, we have globalized images. Now that is globalization of violence. This kind of violence is all present, like CNN. It doesn't care about territories. It's there and here, it's inside and outside. You don't know exactly where it is and what it is. The aggression is transnational, and vulnerability, if you want, is a transnational phenomenon. Now, if that is going to be the future, if you want, or if I should say it maybe for a little bit more for Americans, there was a phrase of Alex de Tocqueville, who about 180 years ago, as you know, wrote Democracy in America. And there he has also a phrase saying, well, the Americans are so secure because they don't have neighbors. Now, I guess what happens with that attack is that it brings home the message that from now on, everybody is going to be everybody's neighbor on this world. And even the most isolated, largest, powerful nation has to realize that it is dependent on neighbors. Or in a way, if you want, this country has grown on the Declaration of Independence. And in a way, the Declaration of Independence has been a little bit revealed as a self-lie, as historically obsolete. We would now, it seems to me, need a declaration of interdependence. And what would that mean? To realize that independence is an unattainable ideal, that interdependence is the condition of this century. Now, and it seems to me what that would mean, to realize that interdependence is the condition of the century, is sure enough, I don't need to say that here, before that audience, that a military response is not enough. Sure enough, you need a long-term political response. And the long-term political response, given that, it seems to me, given that background, can only be to try at least to contain the transnationalization of violence by a transnationalization of justice. Since we cannot identify states, since it has become so difficult to identify aggressors, the rational response is to try to create conditions in this world which at least hope that sources of violence will not, you know, open up again, will not feed new kind of violence, that we are not going to have another attack of that kind in 30 or 40 years from now, which will hit our children and grandchildren. So security here cannot be had without security of others. And security of others basically means that others out there have some fundamental rights that, in a way, humiliation, defeat, fear, insecurity, let's say, is being mitigated. Now, true enough, you see where I wanted to, in a way, to get at, a world which is chronically split in rich and poor, in the arrogant and the humiliated, is barely going to be a world which can, in a way, live up to that new condition of interdependence. And I guess the idea I would like to submit to you is, if interdependence, if transnationality in this sense, is the condition, you know, of life in this century, then it seems to me that democracy worldwide, fundamental rights worldwide, paradoxically, become the condition for national security. The only way you can protect yourself is by giving others less reason to hit. So the only way you can protect yourself is to help, if you want, that rights, that a certain form of democracy, of recognition, is being spread, is present in the world tomorrow. Therefore, my little conclusion about September 11, you know, of course, it's on a different time scale than those responses which are enacted right now. But if you take a slightly larger time scale, then it seems to me pretty obvious. Security has become a matter of worldwide justice. If there is no justice, we will have to expect similar explosions in ways we don't even imagine right now. Okay, that brings me to my second sentence around which I would like to organize some reflections. That is, without ecology, there won't be any transnational justice. Now, it's interesting to see how the theme of justice is coming back into the public discussion. Not because 9/11, but also if you look, for instance, the movement for an alternative globalization, or you might say anti-globalization movement or whatever, the core value here is also justice. However, I see a problem here. The problem is that we have a reemergence of that ideal, but surprisingly for me, people don't quite face the changing context for international justice today. You might look into The Economist or into Le Monde Diplomatique. So you have one of the neoliberal, the other one, you know, kind of left publication. You won't find, it seems to me, the clear idea that justice today has moved into a new historical era. Why is that? Because in the meanwhile, it has become clear that the desire for justice can easily collide with the stability of the biosphere. That the desire for recognition, for equal footing, the desire of southern countries to be recognized, to be respected, taken seriously, that this desire easily collides with the biophysical limits of the Earth. Now, why is that? Let me just elaborate that for a minute, although I might say something which is a totally matter of course for you. For many, many years, thinking about justice, in particular international context, was identified with thinking about growth. One identified justice and growth to a certain extent. Why? Because, to say it in this famous metaphor, which is very well known to you, the metaphor of the pie. That was the ruling hope, since we have a growing pie, it is not so important to look how large the shares are. Because also those who have gotten small parts of the pie eventually will have larger parts, since the overall pie is growing. Now that has been the social democratic conception, if you want, of justice, not only domestically, but also internationally. Now, to say it in a simple and straightforward way, what the environmental predicament tells us is the pie is not going to grow. So the perspective that the pie can grow has become obsolete. That in a way from now on, one is better off expecting, let us say, a stable pie. And of course, now the question of justice comes back, because the moment the pie doesn't grow, it becomes crucial to ask how large are the parts which are, distributed from this pie. Well, just to say about what I'm speaking here, you probably know very well. Let me take simply that one figure which is used by those people who have done research into the environmental footprint. Any country, any city for that matter, leaves an environmental footprint on the planet, which oftentimes is larger than the territory of that country. Calculations have shown that since about the mid-70s, the overall environmental footprint of human activities is overshooting the carrying capacity of the Earth. Now you say, how come that we don't feel that? That lies in the methodology, because the methodology translates fossil resource use into biological area units. Since we live very much of fossil resources, we do not feel that overshoot, because we don't need the biologically active surface area for all these fuel resources. We still have those resources available in its fossil form. Nevertheless, it is probably today so that the human activities taken together overshoot the carrying capacity of the Earth by 35%. Now, if you factor in the needs of non-human living beings, then you would say it's about 50%. So already today, in a certain way, humanity lives by 50% beyond its means. Or in other words, if today the Earth can take every year about 13 billion tons of CO2, it will be absorbed through the plankton, through the biomass, the seas and whatsoever. If all countries followed the German example of fossil fuel use and of CO2 emissions, the world today would emit about 66, 67 billion tons of CO2. So it's about five times than the biosphere can take. So in other words, we would need five planets to serve as sinks for a fully developed world. Again, an impossibility. Therefore, the conclusion on that is, in a way, justice and limits have to be thought together. any discussion on justice today has at the same time has to encompass a consideration of limits. Because in the last 30 years, we have come to the insight that the environmental space, that the biosphere is finite. So again, in other words, for many, many years or decades or centuries, we knew that in order to have justice, you have got to contain power. And now there is a second experience. In order to have justice, you have got to contain the use of nature. For that reason, it seems to me that very systematically today, if you want to speak about transnational justice, transnational equity, you have at the same time got to speak about the limits of nature. So there won't be any transnational justice without ecology. Well, my third kind of phrase I would like to go around. I said north and south are zombie categories. Zombie categories are categories which are used in everyday speech, which are considered natural quasi, but categories which do not correspond to reality. North and south are categories of that kind. North is a category which covers all kinds of different countries, from the US, if you want, to Norway, with many, many differences. It's much more so with South. South covers such a diversity of countries, from Singapore, which is among the richest countries of the world, to, let's say, Mali, which is among of the poorest countries in the world. So it's very difficult to see any common denominator between these countries. The more so we don't even know what Russia is or what Kazakhstan is. Is it south? Is it north? We don't know exactly. So north and south, in reality, are just diplomatic artifacts. We only speak about north and south because, you know, the UN system is organized to go north and south, because the negotiations are about north and south. You have the G77 and the G7, all of that. But it's a categories which do not correspond to reality. Now, the most important reason why it doesn't respond to reality is that the real dividing line in today's world is not running between north and south. It is not running between northern and southern countries. Instead, the real dividing line, if such a thing exists, runs right through all countries. In a way, divides each country. Because something has happened in the last 50 years. Development has brought about something. Development has brought about what I would call a global middle class. A global middle class of people who are very similar to each other, who have similar lifestyles, similar consumption styles. And in fact, if you want to try to quantify the global middle class, I would say let's talk about those who have access to a car. We have about 500 million cars in the world. Let's say 2 to 3 people per car, so it's about 1.2, 1.5 billion people in the world you can count among the global middle class or the global consumer class. Sure, the bulk of them lives in North America and in Europe and in Japan. But I would roughly say 1/5, if not even 1/4 of them lives in countries of the south. There is a global middle class sitting even in Mali and even in Botswana. And sure enough, there is an entire Germany sitting in India, because the Indian middle class might be around 80, 100 million people. That's about the size of Germany. The difference, of course, that in India, there are other 900 million, which are not part of that, the Indian outlet of the global middle class. And the global middle class, in a way, is linked up by a circuit of
goods, images, information, money, travel, education, all of that. Those people, like all of us, probably, who in a way, I don't know, wear the same brands, go to similar films, movies, you know, take part in what you could call a kind of global communication. You know what I'm saying. So the real divide today, it seems to me, which runs through each country, although in different ways, is between, on the one hand, the global consumer class, and on the other hand, those parts of the population which are more or less excluded from that, you know, the economy of global circuits. And sure enough, you have them in each country, but in different configurations. You know, in this country, I guess they're about 14% under the so-called poverty line. So the South is sitting right here in the United States. Like on the other hand, as I said, the North is sitting in India. So in a way, what is the dividing line today is, on the one hand, you have the globalized rich. On the other hand, you have the localized poor. You have a globalized North as well as a globalized South. And the more we speak about, keep on speaking about North and South, this dividing line is blurred. It's concealed. And it makes it so difficult to take into account the fact that it's not North and South, but that this line runs through each society. Now, my fourth sentence I would like to meditate on a little bit is particularly that marginalized majority. I mean, those people who are excluded outside of the grand global circuits. These people are particularly dependent on resources and living systems. Let me illustrate that with the Salman story, which maybe is not as relevant here as it is in Germany, but you will pick up the point. As I came here first in the States, I had never eaten salmon before. It was only here that I got to know salmon. Now that's different now. Germans have taken to eating salmon. Eat quite a lot, they like it. Now, of course, there is no salmon in Germany. Not because we have so polluted rivers, but you know, there is not the, it doesn't grow. So salmon comes where? It comes from Scotland and from Norway. Now, of course, also in Scotland and Norway, there is not so much wild salmon that you could feed the Germans. So it's basically farmed salmon coming from aquaculture in Scotland, Norway, also other places. Now the problem with any kind of farmed animals is what? Where do you get the feed from? You've got to feed these animals. Now to understand where the feedstuff comes from for the salmons, I take you to a place called Chimbote, a town in Peru, along the Pacific coast. If you come to Chimbote, kind of smell in the air. If you go closer to the port, it stinks. If you look, you see kind of a creek and river, a kind of a reddish color. You see, when you're on the port, the fish trawlers moving in and out. Now, sure enough, the fish trawlers bring, you know, this little fish, bring the little fish into the factories at the shore in Chimbote. The factories transform this fish into fish meal, and the fish meal is brought to Europe to feed the salmon. Now you need 5 kilos of fish meal in order to grow 1 kilo of salmon. Now what is happening here? The Germans feast on the salmon. Take it for lunch, looks like a low-calorie kind of food, you know, it's a typical postmodern diet. And pollution and the food crisis and the declining local fishing economy, that is left down there in Peru or in Ecuador. That is a typical
global commodity chain.
Global commodity chains have been there for quite some time. They have grown, as you know, now with globalization. And these global commodity chains, in a way, redistribute the gains and the costs, the benefits and the burdens in the world economy. And it tends to be like you know from the food chain, it tends to be that the advantages are concentrated on the top end, and the disadvantages are concentrated on the bottom end. So is it that the Germans like to have, seems to be healthy, it is not really healthy, but it seems to be healthy, fish and the dirt and the food scarcity is left in other countries, in Latin America in this case. Climate change will hit. It means then that fertility of agriculture, that conventional kind of vegetation, that storms, monsoons, seasons, all conditions which so far have rendered a particular place habitable, that these conditions of habitability are changing. Consequences for people, of course. Consequences for people who get less produce from their fields, who have to walk further for water, are surprised by monsoons rushing down, might be the sea level is rising, or what have you. And sure enough, it hits those who are most vulnerable and who are also innocent. It hits those who have not caused the climate change. Those who are the perpetrators are, relatively speaking, the winners, and those who are innocent are the losers. More so, those who are the losers are the most vulnerable, are exactly those people who are most exposed, if you want, to the whims of nature. It is the fisher folks along the coast of Senegal. It is, the rice peasant in the Mekong Delta in Vietnam. It is the poor Indio family sitting in a hut, you know, at that steep slopes in La Paz. Because the fish might disappear, the water in the Mekong Delta might rise, the slope might transform itself into a mudslide. These people are being affected. So if I just pull that further, if you look at what does that mean? It means that climate change in reality is a human rights issue. It is an issue of, let me put it that way, it seems to me the core of human rights, since the Bill of Rights, is that physical integrity gets protected. We have come used to the notion that the physical integrity has to be protected against the intrusion of the state. Therefore, we have, you know, you shouldn't be tortured. There is a certain dignity which has to be maintained. The inviolability of houses and all of that belongs in that group of rights. And what seems to me is going to happen now is that the physical integrity of people is being threatened over long distances. Teletransported. Threats are teletransported through atmospheric chemistry. And people in other places have to expect that their physical integrity is going to be threatened. So it seems to me here it's very clear how ecology has become an equity in the sense of a human rights issue. Now, I would like rather going on to my last two points. I said, what is more important than poverty alleviation is wealth alleviation. I did say at the beginning that the environmental space is finite. Therefore, justice can only be discussed in the context of limits. Sure, the environmental space is finite, but not everybody gets the same share. In fact, the environmental space is divided in a very unfair manner. I mean, you know the rule of the thumb that about 20% of the world population use 80% of the resources. that is still more or less correct. It's different if you look at paper, if you look at fish, if you look at energy. It varies a little bit, but more or less the rule of the sum is still correct. And as my example of the salmon shows, in a way the global consumer class has been able to throw a spider's web of resource flows across the globe. And that spider's web, in a certain way, pulls resources from many places in the world towards the centers where normally the consumer class sits. And the magnetism, of course, is called purchasing power. Those who have purchasing power are going to prevail on the global market. And therefore, resources are being pulled away from those who depend on them to a great extent, you know, towards the high purchasing power market, as my example of the salmon tried to illustrate. Now, it seems very clear, and that is obvious, that there is not going to be equity or justice in the world as long as the North or the global consumer class entertains that excessive use of the environmental space, as long as the pieces being claimed are still as excessive as they are. I mean, after all, in the next 40, 50 years, we're going to have twice as many people in the world as we have today. And nearly all of them will come on this world not in America and not in Europe, but in the South. And the only way to extend a certain kind of hospitality to these new arrivers is to retreat from the environmental space which has been excessively used by the North so far. So in other words, there is some environmental disarmament needed in order to make space for other peoples, and in particular for people who are still coming. Now, how to do that? If you look at the enormous achievements of the West, if you want, of our societies, and the kind of wealth we have created, I guess it's today important to be clear that this is a type of wealth of a particular characteristic. It is a type, a style of wealth which is incapable of justice. Because it's not that we are taking resources, you know, at will or even for our pleasure. It is because we have set up a system of consumption and production which organizes and produces a certain form of wealth. And that kind of system, in a way, pulls resources towards the more affluent. So the style of wealth we have come up with is a wealth which is incapable of justice. A wealth, if you allow me to say it in a slightly abstract manner, which is structurally oligarchic. Because the moment we would democratize that type of wealth, the biosphere would be sent into turbulences. The moment we would democratize across the world the automobile society, chemical agriculture, meat-based nutrition, and all of these things, the Earth couldn't stand it. So it is a kind of wealth which can only survive because only a minority has got it. Out of that diagnosis, you can conclude, if you want, what the historical challenge is for the North. It is to invent styles of wealth which are capable of justice. Styles of wealth which, at least in principle, could be spread across the world without sending the biosphere into troubles. And I would, in this sense, I would rephrase, if you want, the historical challenge, if you want, the mission of environmentalists. I guess for too much a time, with all honors to the WWF or Greenpeace, if you want, for too long a time we have spoken that ecology is about protecting birds or about protecting whales. No. Ecology is about creating the conditions for world citizenship. It's about creating the conditions for a slightly more fair world. It's about creating the conditions for fundamental rights in the future. And in that sense, it's even about creating conditions for security. So if you want, my last phrase or meditation would be creating a resource-light economy is a step towards global justice. Many of the things we have learned to do over the last 20 or 30 years has, again, even a different quality than we thought so far. I mean, we have tried to come up with ecological housing, to have more fuel-efficient cars, to go into organic agriculture, to find ways of living and of living well with less resources. And we have done it thinking of the earth, thinking of nature, thinking of animals. But in fact, this is fine. It is something else even at stake. That is, as I said, the possibility of fairness in the world. And so the two perspectives, it seemed to me, which are so important for an environmental transition are efficiency on the one side and sufficiency on the other side. To do the things right, that is efficiency. Not doing things in a wasteful manner when they can be done in a more elegant, in a more clever, in a more prudent manner. And doing the right things, which is sufficiency, trying to see what is it what we need for well-being, for good life, and to organize our society accordingly. So that has so long been always the environmentalist agenda to a certain way, and my point is that this is also a contribution to global justice. So if one speaks about justice today, the point is not to learn in the first place to give more, but the point is to learn to take less from others. Thank you very much.
The question I have is, what, in your view, is the likelihood that we will be achieving this global social justice within our lifetimes?
Well, you see, what would you have said if somebody had asked you 200 years ago, let's say the time of Jefferson, do you think we will ever achieve freedom of press, freedom of opinion? And we are speaking about a question or an issue of the same order of magnitude. So I guess I'm saying two things with that. I'm saying there will never be a final state. It will never be possible to say now we have reached it. Like it is impossible to say when we have finally reached the freedom of speech and freedom of press. Because the moment we have reached something, somebody else takes it away again, and the struggle begins again. So it is an up and down, and up and down, and up and down. There is no final stage. That issue of biophysical limits is going to stay with us for, I don't know, the next centuries. And it will surface and resurface in many different ways. Which second means that we also should think in a longer breath. Like at the time of Jefferson, you know, it was not done within a year or 10 years. But looking back, we are today grateful that we can reach back to that legacy of people who have, you know, kept on pushing that issue, and people who also have kept on sacrificing themselves for that cause. And it will be the very same thing, you know, in that area. I mean, if you ask me how I think that change happens,
One way of thinking about it is that it's a mixture of competence and catastrophe. Catastrophes happen and will happen, and either one learns out of catastrophes or one doesn't. So catastrophes can have a very regressive effect if they are not compensated by competence in society. So it seems to me that on the one hand, in society, small pockets of competence grow. By themselves, they are not going to become important or mainstream. It needs an external trigger. Let's call that catastrophe. And the moment the catastrophe is there, then suddenly competence can move into the public eye because it shows it's relevant. Like, for instance, it happened last year, very much so, in Europe with the BSE crisis and, you know, the mad cow disease. You know, suddenly, even the German chancellor stood up and said, we need to go for organic agriculture. Mm-hmm. You know, never heard of. And sure enough, he only could say that because there were all, you know, these farmers or freaks or whatever doing organic agriculture, tiny, tiny, but the infrastructure was in place. One knew how to do it. Food markets were there. Community-based direct marketing or whatever. So it was there. So you knew where to build on. And you knew where to start. That allowed you to have a creative reaction to a crisis. And that seems to me is very, very typical. If the one happens of the other, and without the other it doesn't work. If the catastrophe is without competence, then, let me give you an example. You might excuse me, but just I just like to talk. I think that that September 11 is this catastrophe without competence. It has hit a country which is ignorant about the rest of the world. Mm-hmm. And the consequence is it behaves accordingly. If it had hit a country which has, let's say, a sizable competence and knowledge about the rest of the world, the answer would have been different. So you have a regressive answer facing a catastrophe. The other thing is also true. The competence without catastrophe probably won't get far. So it is these two legs, it seems to me.
How do you see the state of the competences in the global setting? How prepared are we to step up when this, or the number of catastrophes happen?
I am again and again impressed by the fact that you meet like-minded people in all countries of the world. Even in countries you would never expect it, like Georgia or Russia. And that once you know where to look, you find smaller and larger pockets of people experimenting, engaging, scientific research, practical examples and all of that. In different guises, we have, you know, situations where you have a huge distance between government and laboratories, like in this country. You have countries like Germany where there's a smaller distance, where you have even the Greens in government. For better or worse, we don't know. So there are different configurations, but I would say there is a real global movement there. And it is surprising to what extent in very many countries people in a vague way, go for a similar kind of, you know, paradigm. It only means we are not speaking about something, you know, some people having some crazy idea someplace. One speaks, I would say, you know, shedding the skin of a civilization. It doesn't happen from 1 o'clock to 2 o'clock. Probably it happens in a way that you recognize it only in retrospect. That you see, look at this. Something has happened here. We didn't even notice. That's all I can say. Yes?
Well, I think this question follows what you just were saying and what you were asked about the competency again. You say you don't really know if it's competency growing, but what worries me so much is that there might be quite a sizable minority all over the earth that one is really not supposed to or allowed to hear from.
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Okay. But I'm worried not that there might not be some real competency there and growing, because of the ecology movement and everything, but that it simply can't get itself together in the kind of political world where power is almost completely on the other side.
Well, I don't deny that. Though, again, that's different from places to places. However, my main reaction would be to say, well, wait a minute, what is power? On the one hand, power is what we conventionally understand by it, you know, who runs government. On the other hand, power has very much also a non-governmental dimension. And we learned from Foucault, in effect, power is very creative. In a sense, power is that what we find is good, which has the grip on our mind and our feelings, what we find is good. And to a great extent, or to a certain extent at least, environmental movement, lifestyle, all of that has to do with what we find is good and what is not good, what our images of excellence are. And that's also power, it seems to me. It's cultural power.
Yes, but you see, the trouble with Foucault is that he doesn't understand who's got the guns and the money, I'm afraid. He doesn't want to talk about that.
Well,
he didn't.
But let me admit, in a way, one of the most successful social movements in the last 20 years has been the women's movement. But power in terms of government was nearly unimportant in that. Please, go ahead.
My question is, we are faced with a challenge to this social justice and ecological use of the resources and wealth of the earth. I go back and say, is there any culture or any society who has done it? Because if I think back of my ancestors, American, South American native, there was also a very inequitable development of hierarchy and use and concentration of power and wealth over people. So, and anywhere I go, you look at in Australia or wherever, it's the same. So, are we faced with a totally new, because we haven't had it, we don't have, even if we go to native, we don't find it. Has been always the abuse of some or others, abuse of, I don't know much about anthropological cultures, but I put the question to you. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. Isn't it the difficulty today that our present world system is an example of that, that power goes hand in hand with resource concentration? For prehistory, for history of our times, it was, however, possible that power could shift elsewhere, that resources could be taken elsewhere, that the scarcity which came in the wake of resource concentration somehow could be overcome or didn't be overcome. I mean, also, many empires went down because they have overstressed things. Now, today, it happens that in tendency, the catchment area of these resources is the Earth. Indeed, in a way, you could say, I don't know, maybe the Mayas went down because they overdid it with their water consumption, or the Romans because of that. And we say the same thing about today's system, but we don't have any other place to move to.
Yes.
So everybody's in the same boat.
Yeah.
Maybe not totally, but in tendency.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So indeed, one is then confronted with the difficulty, is it possible, how should I say, to retool power? And is it possible to cut back that connects between concentration of power and concentration of resources? Or probably you bring down the concentration of resources only at the same time as you can mitigate power.